Welcome to this session. It's an update from the Superannuation and Employee Benefits Committee. And basically they're covering all the reviews that have been happening and any other things that are of interest. So there's the Henry Cooper Ripoll Johnson report, what happened in the budget, and then the rest. So our speakers today are Paul Chaloux and Matthew Burgess. Paul's the principal with Mercer in Melbourne. His current responsibilities include monitoring legislative developments and providing consulting advice to a wide range of employers and fund trustees on superannuation and related issues. Paul is a member of the SCBPC and also the chair of the Legislative Subcommittee. Matthew is the second speaker. He's the Director of Employee Actuarial and Benefits Consulting in Australia for Russell Investments. Matthew spent all of his career in superannuation. He's the actuary to several large public sector and private sector superannuation funds. He's also a member of the SCBPC and on the Legislative Subcommittee. So welcome, Paul.
Thanks, Diane, and good morning, everyone. Yes, there's certainly been a lot of activity in the area of superannuation with inquiries and government reviews over the last 12 months or so. In particular, the Cooper Super System Review and the Henry Taxation Review. And there have been other reviews such as the Ripoll Financial Services Inquiry and the Johnson Report on Australia as a financial centre, which also have implications for super funds and their providers. This morning I'll be dealing with an overview of the super issues coming out of the Henry Review and the government's 2nd of May announcements, which provided its initial response to Henry. I'll also take a break from inquiries and fill you in on a recent Institute submission that's gone off to Treasury in the last week or so on the more mundane subject of national tax contributions, where there's still quite a number of issues that remain there. I'll then start with some initial comments on the Cooper reviews and hand over to Matthew, who will cover some of the Institute submissions in relation to Cooper's review, as well as the recent budget announcements and the current Super Practice Committee issues. So, firstly, the government released the Henry Report and its initial response on the 2nd of May, so a week and a half or so ago, and somewhat unexpectedly, superannuation improvements formed the centrepiece of those announcements. Perhaps not from the mining industry's viewpoint, but certainly from our viewpoint. In regard to super guarantee, the super guarantee will increase from 9% to 12% over the 6 years from 2013 to 2019. Well, actually 7 years, I guess. There's 0.25% improvements and then 0.5% improvements. I guess it would have been nicer if there could have been a faster schedule to reach the 12%. However, it's, I guess, fair to recognise that the slower build-up does allow for those increases to be absorbed into wage negotiations and for hopefully still real wage increases to be granted over that period where there are offsets for the super guarantee. The increase in the super guarantee maximum age from 70 to 75 is also a welcome change and comes in from 1st of July 2013 and should encourage older workers to remain in the workforce. And that's certainly consistent with Institute recommendations. It also tidies up some of the inconsistencies in the SIS contribution rules with the super guarantee requirements. From an actuarial viewpoint, the increase in the super guarantee rates will raise design issues for defined benefit funds. How should those increases be taken into account? Should they form additional benefits, or should they go towards an increase in underlying minimum requisite benefits? And if the latter occurs, then minimum benefits will be even more likely to overtake defined benefits, and funding and solvency issues will become even more pronounced than they are at present. Also note that the unions have already signalled that they will be pushing for an earlier build-up to the 12% via wage negotiations. Moving on to the second dot point, there's been considerable pressure on the government to address what's seen as a discrepancy in the superannuation tax concessions between low-income earners and high-income earners. And there was much speculation prior to the budget that high-income earners would be hit with a higher tax on superannuation contributions. The government decided instead, as they put it, to lift up the low-income earners rather than pulling down the high-income earners. What they've decided to do is provide a rebate of contributions tax of up to $500 in the form of a government contribution to the super fund for members with adjustable taxable incomes of up to $37,000. Now, $37,000 is the top of the 15% marginal tax rate threshold. And if you take 9% of $37,000, you get $3,333. And so the 15% tax equates very closely to $500 for someone earning $37,000. Now, as the super guarantee increases, the top level of $500 arguably should increase because 12% of $37,000 would give you a higher amount of contributions tax than $500, but we'll see what happens on that score. Those rebates relate first to contributions paid in the 2012-13 year, with the rebates to be paid in the following year. There will be millions of these refunds, and so there'll be a lot of processing for super funds, so it's essential for this to be done efficiently for reforms to be made to, or for an efficient processing system between funds and the tax office to be developed. And I think there's some room for improvement there. The third issue relates to the $50,000 contribution limit for the over 50s. Another welcome change. There's been a lot of calls for the transitional limit to be extended. It was currently due to run out 1 July 2012. So this is a welcome change to have that extended indefinitely. Not so excited about the condition that it will only apply to people whose superannuation balance is up to $500,000. There are a number of issues associated with that condition. Super funds at the moment don't need to report member balances, so this would be an additional reporting requirement. How will balances be measured for defined benefit funds? Will they be withdrawal benefits for active members? How will it work for pensioners and deferred pensioners? There are also issues with funds that don't balance at 30th of June. Will they need to do extra work to establish 30th of June balances? And there are also some concerns about what ways and means people might try and use to get around the $500,000 balance limit. Will they be people in their 60s pulling out money to get under $500,000 before 30th of June and so they can put a $50,000 contribution in the next year? Will it mean the return of contribution splitting and so on? The Henry Report made a large number of recommendations in regard to super, and really only the $50,000 limit change has been taken up so far, and there's been a condition put on that. However, when releasing its initial response, the government did move to avoid potentially, I guess, damaging speculation leading into an election, and has ruled out a number of changes, some of which are listed there. And it also extended to ruling out a reduction in the 50% capital gains tax discount and applying a discount to negative gearing arrangements. The ones on the next consider list were referenced in the government response, have seen some subsequent announcements in the budget, and Matthew will deal with those. There were also a lot of the Henry recommendations that weren't ruled out, and one of these was quite a radical revamp of taxation on superannuation. Firstly, what Henry's proposal was that all superannuation contributions should be included in personal taxable income and that there should be a flat tax rebate. So, for example, under Henry's proposal, there would be, or what he illustrated, was a marginal tax rate of 35% on middle incomes up to $180,000. And he suggested that perhaps a 20% rebate in combination with that would mean there was effectively a 15% tax remaining on superannuation contributions, and that rebate would be payable up to contributions of $25,000 for those under 50 or $50,000 for those over 50. The difference would be, though, that there would be no tax on the fund, so that was in combination with zero tax on the super fund. So effectively, the contribution tax would move from being paid by the fund to being paid by the member. He did note that there might be some transitional issues associated with that sort of arrangement. So what the government decided to do in introducing the rebate to low-income earners could, I guess, be seen as a rejection of that proposal by Henry. And it's interesting to note that under Henry's proposal, with a 9% superannuation guarantee and no tax on contributions, and as you'll see, the next point's a lower tax on investment income, the adequacy of that arrangement is not that different from the adequacy of a 12% super guarantee with tax taken off, equates to around a 10% net contribution. So maybe there's not that much difference between the Henry adequacy sort of view on super guarantee and the government's proposal. In regard to Henry's proposals for tax on investment income, he was essentially proposing that superannuation funds should pay zero tax on investment income, and he, in his view, a tax of around 7.5% would be offset to a large extent by dividend imputation credits, and so that pretty much equated to a zero-type effective tax. A reduction in tax to 7.5% on investment income for super funds in the growth phase would be very welcome, but I guess less welcome to have a tax on superannuation fund investments in the pension phase. And there would be particular issues there for defined benefit pension funds. And also, I guess it would have an impact on the incentive to invest in self-managed super funds, where one of the key advantages that's put forward is the ability to avoid capital gains tax by holding investments and realising capital gains in the pension phase. The other proposal that Henry put forward was that there'd be a 40% discount on personal savings income from interest, dividends, capital gains, and any other savings income. Now, we would be concerned if that was done without reducing the superannuation fund investment income tax down to 7.5%. So, for example, someone on the 30% tax rate, if there was a 40% discount, would effectively pay 18% tax on personal investment income as compared with a 15% superannuation fund tax. We don't think that would be a big enough difference to justify the locking up of superannuation contributions, and so we think that would have a detrimental effect on voluntary savings. So Matthew will make comment about the change that the government's actually announced in regard to personal savings income. I guess it's pleasing to see that there's been some limit on that, which should alleviate concerns about the potential impact on superannuation savings. Henry also recommended that the government assist in development of a longevity market. There were a number of ways that he suggested that they could do this. One was by issuing long-term securities to help providers manage investment risk. He did qualify that to say only where it was consistent with the government's fundraising needs. Another suggestion was to provide data to enable a tradable longevity index to be created. To remove restrictions on the rules in SIS, which restrict the types of pensions that can be offered. Now, Henry's proviso on that was that he only wanted to see that done if there was a 7.5% tax on investment income in the pension phase. He also said that the government should consider offering a government annuity and a deferred annuity product, and I guess we've seen that the government in its response has ruled that out. Moving on to the Ripple inquiry, we had a fair bit of discussion yesterday from Joanne Block on some of the implications of that, so I won't go into any detail there. However, I will mention one thing that is of a small thing, which is a bit of a niggle with superannuation practitioners, and that's the requirement to provide statements of advice to employers because they're regarded as retail clients. One of the issues that was flagged was a review of the classification of sophisticated and unsophisticated investors. So hopefully that might eventually lead to a change there where BHP and ANZ and ACS are regarded as unsophisticated investors. Notional tax contributions. As I mentioned, we've recently made a submission to Treasury on some remaining issues with notional tax contributions. These cover a number of areas. Firstly, the grandfathering rules, by which notional tax contributions are limited to the concessional contributions limit. I'll keep going. Concessional contributions limit for eligible members. One of the problems areas is members losing grandfathering in some successor fund transfers. The government did make some changes in the middle of last year to try and alleviate these difficulties, but there are still some gaps in the rules, and we'd like to get those fixed. Another grandfathering issue is whether a change in benefits on, say, 1 June results in loss of grandfathering, and whether the loss applies for the whole of the financial year. And so whether it's retrospective for 11 months, we don't think that it should be, and we're seeking some changes to achieve that. Okay, another question is whether a member who's lost grandfathering can regain it. For example, if a member loses grandfathering due to moving to a category with a higher new entrant rate in 1 year, if they move back to a category with a lower new entrant rate that's not higher than when they first, than it was on 12th of May 2009 under the grandfathering rules, do they regain grandfathering? We think they do, but we've asked for confirmation of that. A bigger area is the determination of additional notional tax contributions on special events, such as an augmented benefit on leaving can give rise to an additional W. Granting of a past service credit could give rise to an additional X amount, or a benefit design improvement, for example, a change in final average salary or an increase in benefit scales that's retrospective, could give rise to an additional amount Y. The regulations in this area are quite problematic and can lead to similar changes having quite different additional NTC outcomes. We think that the regulations need a significant rewrite to achieve consistent and reasonable results, including situations such as DBDC conversions and plan wind-ups. We've also, in the submission, raised a number of what we've called integrity issues, where there seems scope for potential, I guess, rorting of the system. The first one relates to augmentations on retrenchment. Now, the way that the augmentation system works is that there's only, if you augment a benefit on leaving, it only gives rise to a W amount if it's on voluntary exit. So really, as it stands, there's no limit on augmentations on a redundancy. We think there should be a limit on such augmentations, and we've suggested that the limit on, I guess, free augmentation should be the greater of the accrued retirement benefit and the retrenchment benefit formula that was in place in May 2009. The second issue relates to the grandfathered cap. As it stands at the moment, it's possible to have an additional national tax contribution arising a WXY or a Z, and to have that, but still retain grandfathering. And in that circumstance, the grandfathered amount would include the additional national tax contribution. So if you had a normal national tax contribution of $40,000 and an additional of $60,000 due to a Y event, for example, so you had a total of $100,000, that could then be capped at $50,000. So effectively there would be, to some extent, a free ride on the benefit improvement. So we suspect that wasn't the intention, and so we've raised that. The third area which we've raised relates to allocations to accumulation benefits in defined benefit funds. And the way the regulations works, it says if you make an allocation to an accumulation benefit from a reserve, then that gives rise to an additional concessional contribution. Some funds have had legal opinions that in their defined benefit fund, the trustee doesn't make any reference to reserves, so that any allocations that they make would not be classified as additional concessional contributions. I should say that one of the examples where that's occurred related to minimum guaranteed interest rates on accumulation benefits, which had been carried over from a defined benefit conversion. Now, from the practice committee's viewpoint, we don't have a concern with that sort of arrangement because we think it's probably not unreasonable that those arrangements shouldn't give rise to additional contributions. But we think there is a gap there that maybe could be taken advantage of with other arrangements. We've also raised a number of other issues relating to a special issue which relates to defined benefit arrangements whereby the member contributions are received as an accumulation component in addition to the defined benefit, but the rate of member contributions affects the defined benefit. We think that in that case, we think that the member contribution should be in the grandfathered amount. So we're arguing that case. The tax office has previously told us that its view is that there aren't, so we're trying that one again. We think we've got a stronger argument there. We've also suggested that target benefit arrangements, which were in place prior to the national tax contribution rules, should be treated as defined benefits and grandfathered. The rules in regard to non-accruing pensions are pretty unworkable at the moment, so any fund that has pensions with discretionary increases can arguably give rise to additional contributions for pensioners, whether they be 85, 95 or 105. So we think they need some improvement. And the final one relates to anti-detriment arrangements where top-ups, anti-detriment top-ups to accumulation interests may be treated as allocations from reserves and give rise to additional tax contributions. Again, an outcome we don't think is intended and should be fixed if the government does agree with that interpretation. Okay, moving on to the Cooper review, there have been a number of reports issued, and I'll deal briefly with these. The first is the Superstream report, which just briefly focused on improving what they call the administrative back office of superannuation. And so it raised a number of ideas for improvements, such as universal use of electronic data and payment transfers, standardised data requirements and formats, and industry-wide protocols for transfers and consolidation of accounts. And if those things can all get up, it will mean a very significant improvement in the efficiency of super funds and substantial cost savings. So that would be a very good outcome. The second preliminary report I wanted to touch on relates is the My Super Choice Architecture Report. I've noted down there a number of the requirements of My Super products. My Super products will be the only ones that will be eligible as default funds for super guarantee contributions. So really, these are the big funds of the future. The other requirements include, some of the other requirements include that there must be no cross subsidies between the My Super section and the Choice section, and that trustees must participate in annual efficiency benchmarking surveys and either form the view that they have sufficient scale, that is, they're competitive, or they need to decide that they're not and to find a suitable fund to merge with so that they will then have sufficient scale. A personal comment, I guess, because we haven't discussed this in detail with the practice committee. My thinking is that much of the My Super framework seems sensible and appropriate, but there are contradictions and a lot of uncertainty in some of the details. For example, the idea is to strive for efficiency, but they've added extra licensing and audit requirements for My Super funds. Things like changing investment options, which often at the moment is quite simple and can be done online, might become considerably more complex because the My Super product has different disclosure arrangements from the Choice product. And so as soon as you go away from the My Super investment arrangement, you become effectively subject to the other disclosure requirements. So it's likely that those sort of things might become more complex if the rules aren't carefully framed. The fee rules are a bit unclear in relation to master funds or setting fees for, say, employer sub-funds of a master fund or an industry fund, whether to what extent discounts can be applied. And so it's a bit unclear whether a master fund is going to have a separate My Super fund for every employer or whether they'll be able to have a My Super sub-fund, which itself has sub-funds, if you like, for each employer and basically has the same sort of rules. So the outworkings, I think, are pretty unclear at the moment. And depending on what the outworkings are, we could see something that's not at all that only is very little different from what we have today or something that is quite different for a number of funds. And in some cases, the differences might be expensive to do. One of the other areas that is very unclear too is the no cross-subsidisation rules and what they actually mean in practice. I think we've all struggled with setting fees for different categories of members, and with any fund, there has to be some degree of cross-subsidisation. It's a natural outcome of setting up group-type arrangements. So I think there will still have to be some room for judgment about what level of cross-subsidy whether a cross-subsidy applies will be, to some extent, remain in the eye of the beholder, I would say. Lastly, on SMS, briefly, the report on SMS also came out in the last few weeks. There wasn't too much revolutionary in that. There was some proposals to prohibit investments in exotics such as artwork and yachts and wine collections and so on. There was also a more flexible ATO penalty regime, which seems a desirable idea, and requirements to strengthen the competency and independence of auditors. Another noteworthy recommendation in that report was that the CIS legislation be restructured, and how they see it being restructured is that you would have one part of CIS which relates to all funds, and then subsections relate to SMSFs and public sector funds, for example, or other sectors of the industry. So it would be would obviously affect funds other than SMFs as well as SMFs. On that note, I will hand over to Matthew to...
Good morning, everyone. Now, there's a lot to cover, and given the time, what I'm going to do is cover some things in detail and leave some things out. So I'll cover the more important things. First of all, as far as the Cooper Review goes, the Institute put in four different submissions and covering the different stages of the Cooper Review. As far as governance goes, the Institute's view is that prudential standard setting should be kept quite separate to regulation, so that APRA should not be given prudential power to set prudential standards, and the lawmaking should remain separate. The Institute also has continued to push for financial condition reports for all superannuation funds. You'd probably be familiar with the Institute's stance on this, that we would like to see accumulation funds produce at least every 3 years financial condition reports, including the material risks impacting the financial condition of an entity. So that was included as a strong recommendation within the governance part of the report. As far as efficiency goes, at a high level, the Institute believes that transparency is the key on fees and costs. That if we have transparent fees and costs, that will lead to efficiency within the industry, and competition will drive that. That superannuation fees and costs should be separated between administration fees and costs and investment fees and costs, disclosed separately and also in a mandated form. Interestingly, given the financial crisis and some of the issues superannuation face around liquid assets, the Institute has suggested that consideration be given to actually allowing members to waive their portability rights. Clearly, holding illiquid assets where there's valuation lags can cause arbitrage opportunities and so forth in a world where there's investment choice and portability. And superannuation funds are considering their allocations to these type of assets and enabling members to waive their ability to exercise those rights is perhaps one way of continuing to allow funds to invest in meaningful ways in those asset classes. As far as structure goes, concentrating now on, I guess, the traditional roles of defined benefit fund actuaries, the Institute put the view that APRA should not be able to go to employers and say and mandate contributions required to be made to superannuation funds. So employers have gone into their trust deed arrangements, committed to the funding of their defined benefit funds, and the Institute didn't think it was appropriate then for additional obligations to be inserted on top of that through regulation. But having said that, the current CIS regulations concentrate almost entirely on technical insolvency. And we all know in practice, we spend lots of our time on unsatisfactory financial position. And yet there is nothing in the regulations about managing unsatisfactory financial condition. There's no requirement to fund it over particular timeframes. There's no consequences under the CIS regulations. So the Institute has put the view in its submission that managing unsatisfactory financial positions should be the focus of the CIS regulations rather than technical insolvency. But there's quite a lot of provisos around that. As I've said, neither the actuary or APRA should be able to dictate employer contribution requirements to employers. Also, that at the moment there's actually a disincentive for employers to contribute more than the minimum amount to defined benefit funds because of issues around who owns surplus. And that's not helpful to encouraging employers to fund superannuation funds well. Also, the issue about what type of time frame is appropriate to rectify if unsatisfactory financial position comes up. Well, APRA has a stated 3-year view, which the Institute supports. Clearly, flexibility is needed around that, and the Institute has put the view that APRA need to be flexible in those timeframes. If you've got government-funded arrangements, if you've got multi-employer funds, there's different issues to other funds, for example. Each case, or APRA needs to have the position to consider each case on its merits. There's quite a few bits of legislation at the moment that don't work particularly well for defined benefit funds. In our submission, we list a few. I'm only going to talk about two now. One is that in a hybrid superannuation fund where you have defined benefit members and accumulation-only members, under legislation at the moment, the MRBs rank first. So you pay out the MRBs for the defined benefit members before you pay out the benefits above the MRBs for the accumulation members. That means that if the defined benefit goes really wrong, accumulation members can miss out on their benefit. And we don't think that's entirely appropriate. Also, there's issues around the funding of pension-only schemes. For example, if you currently have a fund with only lifetime pensioners in it, then it's debatable whether you're allowed to put additional contributions to top up the funding of that scheme when there's a deficiency. And those contributions, if you were able to do it, would not be tax deductible. The submission also talks about self-insurance being a potential option under certain conditions for the very, very largest of accumulation funds, and also talks about that the government needs to do more to encourage longevity products. And I think Paul's covered that, so I won't say any more. Okay. On the budget, I think it's all pretty simple. I think that you've probably read it all, and given time, I think I might just skip straight over that. Similarly, the Johnson report, given that what Hazel said this morning, we heard her views. The Johnson report was released in January to promote Australia as a financial services hub or make recommendations to the government. The government picked up the vast majority of the Johnson review's recommendations in the budget. I've listed some of the ones they did take up there, and if you want to know more, speak to me afterwards. As far as other things the SCBPC is doing, is that there has been big debate throughout the insurance industry about the deductibility of disability insurance premiums. In the 1997 Tax Act, they defined a superannuation disability benefit, and the definition was narrower than the trustee definitions of many disability benefits. Now, legally, that meant only part of insurance premiums paid by lots of superannuation funds, whether self-insured or externally insured, was deductible. While the government has announced that it will extend the ability to use the old definitions and make their premiums deductible to 30 June 2011, there's still nothing beyond that. Definitions around loss of limbs or own occupation and so forth are clearly more broad than the current tax definition. There is draft legislation about at the moment. We have till early June to comment on that, to extend the disability definition through to 30 June 2011. The Institute is working with other industry bodies, all the other main industry bodies, to put a joint submission to try to lobby to have that extended beyond 30 June 2011. I might say briefly that one of the fixes in the budget was around terminal medical condition, because currently premiums paid for terminal medical condition benefits are also not tax deductible. But in the budget, it was announced that that would be fixed. On anti-detriment, all I will say is that you're probably aware, if you not go onto the Institute website, you'll see that in September last year there was a discussion note issued for the calculation of anti-detriment provisions for defined benefit funds. Now, that's not a mandated approach. It's voluntary, but it sets out an approach that can be used while allowing discretion for actuaries to use other approaches if they consider appropriate. At the moment, with benefit certificates, if we have, again, our hybrid funds with a pure DB and pure accumulation members within the same fund, we have to produce a benefit certificate for those pure accumulation members, or the benefit certificate has to cover them. That can lead to those accumulation members being treated differently to how they may be treated in an accumulation fund. The new PS 403, which is to replace Guidance Note 456 on benefit certificates, will try to address that to the extent we can. But there is issues for actuaries preparing benefit certificates covering accumulation members. For example, there are defined benefit funds that are public offer. There are defined benefit funds with thousands of employers contributing SG contributions into these pure accumulation categories. An actuary has a responsibility to get some type of assurance about the level of contributions those employers are making to certify a 9% coverage in a benefit certificate. So in the Cooper Review submission, we actually suggested that actuaries should have discretion not to provide the benefit certificate for, or working with trustees, not to provide the benefit certificate for their pure accumulation members, and that they be covered under the normal SG requirements for accumulation funds. There are circumstances where we would want to provide a benefit certificate, such as when surplus is being used to meet the contributions of the accumulation members. We would be interested in your views on that. The SCPC is also considering writing a separate submission to Treasury on that issue. So if you have views, please let me know. On professional standards, all I'll do is say briefly, PS 404 on asset valuation was released last year. PS 407 on funding solvency certificates released recently. PS 405 on the cost of death and or insurance, deductible of insurance premiums for death and disablement benefits has been released for comment. We've had comments back. That should be finalised over the next month or so. We're releasing a new PO 406 on unsegregated pension liabilities, the deductibility of the exemption in respect of investment tax on pension assets is coming soon, but obviously we'll release it for comment first. PS 400 on triennial valuations has been released for comment twice. It is nearly ready for finalisation. There are very material changes in that. Please read it. If you're practising in the superannuation area, you need to. And PS 403, I think I mentioned, on benefit certificates should be in a position to be released to members for comment fairly soon. IAS 19, the international accounting bodies released potential updates to that. We would expect them to flow through to AASB 119 if they're finalised. And there is reasonably material changes. We have till September to comment, so we'll be looking at that. The two most significant changes I would consider that when we calculate superannuation expense, we normally include an interest cost component as well as a return on asset component. The return on asset component at the moment is calculated on best estimate investment return. The proposal is to use a government bond discount rate to calculate a component based, well, combining the interest component and the return on asset component into a single component. Using a government bond rate to calculate return on asset obviously will increase superannuation expense significantly for many of our employer sponsors of defined benefit funds, arguably making it an overstatement of the real cost, because all gains and losses need to flow through other comprehensive income rather than profit and loss. So that's the second, what I would consider, material change, and that is that the corridor approach, the proposal is not to allow it in the future, and also not to allow gains and losses to be put through profit and loss, but to always require them to go through what we either call retained earnings or other comprehensive income. So I hope I've left out enough of what I was going to say to leave a little bit of time for comment, and I'll hand back to Diane.
Anyone got a comment or question? I know we don't have much time, but we might be able to fit a couple in. Did you want to say something then on some of the stuff you left out, Matthew?
Does anyone want to know anything about the Johnson Report, for example? Everyone's shaking their heads. I mean, it's quite a big deal for the investment management industry because, I mean, I guess they want to introduce what's called an investment management regime, which is all... I'll ignore my notes. It's basically to try to review the way overseas investors investing in Australian managed funds are taxed. So to try to make it clear that they will pay no tax in Australia so they can invest in Australian management funds without having to worry about Australian tax and hopefully make Australia a more attractive place to invest. In respect of managed investment trusts, they're trying to clarify the tax law to make it clear that Australian investors investing in managed investment trusts, that the tax will pass directly through to them and that there's no risk of double taxation. And that's obviously a good thing. Withholding tax. Currently, when financial institutions borrow from overseas, on the interest that they pay on that borrowing, there's a 10% withholding tax. There is an announcement to reduce that withholding tax. The government said in the long term it would like to reduce that to zero. Finally, in respect of corporate debt, they're planning to introduce the ability for corporations to release bonds to retail investors based on short-form prospectuses. So I guess they were some of the main recommendations out of the Johnson Report, and the government's picked them all up.
Okay, I think we're ready for lunch. Thanks, everyone. And thank you to Paul and Matthew, especially during the trying times, hearing Matthew speak. We have gifts for you as well. Thanks, everyone.